we're continuing in the Kuzari. We're on page 57. We're up to the third big number three. And actually, we're up to the big number four. Just review where we're up to at this point. The first person that King Bulan decided to seek out after having this dream where an angel comes to him in the dream and tells him, your intentions are desirable to your creator, but not your deeds. So he decides to seek out a philosopher, as we mentioned, because the philosopher represents, at least to, you know, people looking at it from in the secular world, you know, you hear so much hype about philosophy in this world that the Khazar king hears about. So he figures, if I'm looking for the truth, I might as well seek out philosophers. So he speaks to the philosopher. The philosopher tells him that his view of life is all about that the purpose of life is seeking wisdom and seeking knowledge, and that really it doesn't make a difference what you actually do with your life, as long as whatever actions you do perform lead you to honing and perfecting your intellect. That was basically the approach that the philosopher was trying to present to the Khazar king. The Khazar king is bothered with this. He says, number one, I got a message from an angel, and the angel told me that there's something that I'm doing that's wrong, or I'm not doing something that I should be doing. And as a result, I can't believe that it really doesn't matter what I do with my life as long as my intellect, as long as my mind is perfected. Because if that's really the purpose of life, then why would the angel give me that kind of message to tell me that your intentions are desirable but not your deeds? It's got to be something to do with my deeds, my ma'asim. It's something that I have to be doing to make myself into a better person or to follow the path. And furthermore, in concluding that there must be a set of activities that is inherently, implicitly desirable, something that I should be doing, he also argues that, look, you see that there's such passion among the other religions of the world between Christians and Muslims. They're willing to kill each other in order to be able to stake a claim as to what the right path of life is all about. Now, you and I would look at it the way the philosopher looks at it, and we would say, people willing to kill each other in order to prove that their religion is the correct religion, that's not virtuous. If anything, that's barbaric. Why would you want to kill in order to preserve your religion? Is religion really worth killing for? And that's really what the philosopher's point is. He says, we're a very rational, civilized kind of people, philosophers. We wouldn't kill anybody in order to try to advance our way of life. We're not here to foist it upon anyone else. We're not here to impose our views upon anyone else. We're not here to try and get the whole world to see our way, and we don't feel so impassioned about it that we'd be willing to kill about it. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi seems to almost allow the philosopher that argument, but I think we have to remember that, as I mentioned the last time we got together, that there's a famous concept that exists out there, that if you have nothing that you're willing to die for, then you really have nothing that you're willing to live for. And that before we dismiss all of religious history among Christians and Muslims who were willing to kill each other for the sake of the preservation of their faith among their nations, the respective nations, we have to also realize that when a person feels so passionately about his or her faith that they're willing to die, I wouldn't say to kill, because killing has to do with the idea of imposing on others. That we're not going so far as to say, but if a person's willing to die, al kiddush Hashem, because they feel so strongly and so passionately about the truth of what they're doing, and that this is something that is yehareg va'al ya'avor, that it's my life is not worth living if I can't live my life as a Jew, then that makes life that much more valuable. If I know that my life stands for something, so much so that if I can't continue that which I value in life, then my life is worth I'm willing to die, then my life has much more value. The philosopher, who is much more the cold, detached, and perhaps a bit stoic in his approach to the acquisition of intellect, doesn't feel that level of passion. And as a result, we can only look at the stoic philosopher and say, Nebuch, you're never going to realize, you're never going to experience the passion and the joy of what it really means to live your life as a Jew. One of the problems that we can sometimes run into in a very intellectual Judaism is that it becomes dispassionate. It becomes devoid of any sense of true emotional expression. And that in itself is problematic. There was a very famous rabbi known as the Yaivitz, there are two Yaivitzes. This was the earlier Val Yaivitz, who lived during the period of the Spanish Inquisition. And he wrote in one of his commentaries something truly frightening. He writes that during the period of the Spanish Inquisition, there were different kinds of Jews. There were some Jews who sacrificed their lives and died al Kiddush Hashem by being burned at the stake by the inquisitors. And there were other Jews who converted to Christianity and became what, you know, the conversos or the maranos, whatever term you want to use. And he says something, he makes an observation. He says the Jews who were the more intellectual, the ones who were more perhaps a little bit learned and were able to find certain halachic loopholes in allowing themselves to convert instead of dying, those were the ones more often than not who became the conversos. You know what kind of Jews were the ones who immediately said, no, I'm going to die al Kiddush Hashem, burn me at the stake right now? That was more of the amcha. Those were the Jews who were the non-intellectuals, the people who really just felt a visceral, passionate form of Judaism, which didn't have the same kind of intellectual approach. And what the Yaivitz was trying to demonstrate from there is that sometimes the intellect gets in the way of living a passionate life that is filled with just a tremendous excitement and a hislahavus, we would say in Hebrew, of service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I think we're going to discover that this is one of the things that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi feels is pathetic about the philosopher's way of life. Very much different from the Maimonidean school, who feels that there is a very, very strong reason for a Jew to engage his intellect in his interpretation and his living of his Judaism. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, no, there's an experiential form of life that can only be experienced in immersing one's physical practice of the mitzvot, and that's really the way to live and experience Judaism. Okay? So just keep that in mind when you hear the philosopher's response that, well, we would never kill anyone over a way of life because we're just a very civilized people. We don't sanction murder. And we also don't sanction murder. But also keep in mind that implicit in that is a little bit of a shtach, is a little bit of a criticism to the philosopher because of his stoic and dispassionate way of approaching what he views his way of life ought to be about. But now we're up to paragraph number four. And in paragraph number four, the Khuzari king is going to present his final dismissive argument against the philosopher. And he starts off, and this is not really in the text, but in addition to whatever criticism you're going to make against organized religion, there are so many mistakes that Christians and Muslims make according to your belief in what you call God, the name of God for the philosopher, if you remember it. Everyone remember the name that the philosopher gives to God? Anyone remember that the term? It was called the prime cause. This initial creator, so Hasiba Harishona, the sort of this entity, this sentient being that is completely detached and removed from the world that philosophers believe in, right? You believe in a God, but you believe in a God that is not interactive and that is non-providential, that is not involved in this world on a constant basis, the way the religions such as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam believe in. And that in itself represents for you a fatal flaw for these other faiths. And that's what we're going to be seeing now. So we'd like to get a reader for, please, go right ahead.
The Khuzari said, is this the only criticism that you can make against
the
organized religion? What error of the other religions could be greater, according to you, than to believe that the world has not existed eternally and that it was created in 6 days? And that what you call the prime cause actually communicates with mankind, despite the philosopher's position, this prime cause is elevated above any temporal knowledge.
So in the biblical world, in the world of religion, God is temporal. He sort of inserts himself within time. He creates the world at a given juncture within world history, such that at one point the world did not exist, and then God all of a sudden decided he was going to create a world. That is philosophically difficult to say that God is bounded in some way by time to begin with. And it's also philosophically difficult to say that at one point God decided that the world had to change. Because for a perfect deity, there can be no change. There is no concept of temporality, of change and giving oneself over to the vicissitudes of time. And so therefore, that in itself is the greatest criticism. And as I mentioned to you before, the Rambam has great difficulty with this. How do we reconcile the fact that God is perfect and completely devoid of physicality and therefore devoid of any chronological confinement, and yet is capable of inserting himself within the world? There are a number of ways that Chazal themselves try to reconcile this difficulty. There's even one approach that says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu first created everything, he embedded all changes that would take place within the initial creation. One of the reasons why Chazal say that, according to the Rambam, is to be able to answer this question. God doesn't just do things and insert himself into time on the fly and sort of change and turn the knobs all of a sudden. Hashem is perfect, and therefore the world that he created is perfect from the very outset, and therefore does not need to be altered and tampered with over the course of time. This is one of the problems that the philosophers have, at least medieval philosophers have, with the whole approach that the biblical religion offers as far as their depiction of God. So anyway, that's the final argument that we're going to see of the philosopher about the flaws within religion. But ultimately, you have to acknowledge one thing. If you believe in a God that is completely detached and is not providential, not involved in your life in any meaningful way because he's too far detached to even know what you're doing, then there seems to be a disconnect, a huge disconnect that the philosopher is going to have in his life between himself and his God. And this leads the Kuzari to say that if you are so correct, then we should have expected to see something happening within the philosophical community, that you should have been able to rise above the rest of the world in your level of humanity and in your sense of perfection of your humanity. But we haven't seen that. So let's see the argument. Page 58.
This being the case, that you are unassailably correct and they are so wrong, and as a result of the philosopher's practices, their wisdom and their efforts at arriving at the truth, we would have expected to see prophecy abounding among them because of their close attachment to spirituality. We should have by now heard of great miracles that occurred through them, and they should already have achieved a reputation for greatness in the world. We see, however, just the opposite. Those who have not studied your wisdom or prepared themselves according to your prescribed methods have achieved divine communication, whereas philosophers have achieved none of this. This indicates to me that the truth about God lies somewhere else, outside of what you have told me, philosopher.
And this final sort of nail on the coffin of the philosopher's arguments is what I would call the proof is in the pudding argument. And what does that mean? The Kuzari's final point to the philosopher is, come on, I hear all of the convincing arguments that you're presenting to me, but at the end of the day, what do you have to show for all of these very sophisticated arguments that you've presented? Can you demonstrate that the philosophers have achieved anything of great import in the world? Can you demonstrate that the philosophers have experienced very special phenomena in their own lifetimes? Have they been privy to miracles in their lives because of this great attachment that they are able to accomplish with what they call the prime cause? No, you can't. Nothing remarkable has happened in the community of philosophers where we can look at some annals of Greek history and say that the great philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, were enveloped in an aura of light and were carried up to heaven. But that happened to the prophet Elijah. So according, the prophet Elijah wasn't a philosopher, he was a prophet, and he communed with God, and he was able to ascend in a chariot of fire up to heaven. Why hasn't that happened to any of you guys, the philosophers? What do you have to show for what you profess to be the truth? that's ultimately the argument that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is presenting. Now, I should point out that while Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's argument seems to be quite convincing, there's actually a book that was written by one of the great philosophers that predated Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Arabic world named Avicenna, where he talks about having visionary experiences and being able to, through his philosophical speculation, being able to be visited by angels. And there are a number of Arabic philosophers who live around the time of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi who really write about Greek philosophy in almost religious terms. And I think Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is trying to demonstrate that really they're just imagining these things. They're really not, there has been no great biblical account of the philosophical community. We have miracles that are recorded about other people in the world, but we don't have any miracles that happen to philosophers. And as we're going to see, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi invests a tremendous amount of weight to miracles in the world. If miracles happen, that means something magical is going on, something special, something remarkable is happening. If we're getting a message here, and if philosophers cannot point to any miracles that have happened to them in their communities throughout the course of history, then it would seem to me that the proof is in the pudding. That in itself should be a reason not that I should look elsewhere. And so that's basically where he's going to drop off the philosopher and say, toodaloo, it's been nice talking to you, but I have to look somewhere else. I have to go somewhere else and sort of try to find the truth, because you sound convincing, but you haven't demonstrated anything in your lives, nor in your forebears, that shows me that there's anything remarkable about you. I want you to keep that in mind as well as we go through the Kuzari. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is very interested in an experiential kind of proof. If you want to prove something to me that I have not been exposed to before in my life, you're going to have to show me something remarkable that has happened to you or to your people in order to show me that there's truth in what you say. Because if just trying to provide me with intellectual arguments is not enough to convince me. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is very skeptical about the soundness of one's own thoughts, of one's own mind. Just because it sounds logical, I can say something to you today, it makes a lot of sense. Someone could say something to you tomorrow that's just the opposite of what I said, and that also makes sense. Like the rabbi and fiddler, right? Rabbi, how could it be? Right, you're right. He's right. Rabbi, how can they both be right? That's also right. In other words, our minds are so easily swayed back and forth by so many different kinds of convincing arguments, right? And so, ultimately, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, and he's putting this in the mouth of the Kuzari, I had a dream. The dream was, I've got to seek out a certain way of life that is going to be satisfying. The philosopher doesn't provide me with that pathway. Despite the fact that his arguments are convincing, what does he have to show for it? I need proof. I need evidence. I need to see something before my eyes that are going to show me that there's something real here. Now, as we're going to try and explore, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is directing us, is taking us down that path, because he's going to try and demonstrate, now that he's dismissed the philosopher, he's going to introduce us to the Christian theologian, and then he's going to introduce us to the Muslim theologian. And both of them are going to come up short for almost the very same reason, that they have nothing to show. There's no proof that they can demonstrate to show the truth of what they are trying to profess, which will ultimately lead us to the question, well, then what does Judaism have to prove? What does Judaism have to show? What proof do we have that what we are professing to be true is true? What makes Judaism more convincing from an evidentiary point of view than Christianity and Islam? And so you have to just be patient, because that's what we're going to try and analyze as we get further and further into the Sefer. But that is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's contention, that Judaism provides the most cogent and convincing evidence that is more irrefutable than the evidence that is provided by Christianity and Islam. Yes?
How important are we just came to kind of, how important are miracles in fact Judaism in terms of reality?
How important? For the Kuzari, they are everything. The reason why they're everything, and you're right, it's very possible that for another way of thinking, miracles don't convince you. But then the question is, what else is there? There are two ways for a person to be convinced of truth. One is using one is using logical arguments to say, well, I've thought it through, and this makes the most sense to me, and therefore I'm going to follow that. And the other way is, like Rabbi Yehuda Levi says at some point later on, you can't deny your eyes. If you see a spectacle, and the spectacle indicates to you that God exists, then no matter how much logic tells you that God doesn't exist, it's impossible that God would not exist if you saw God. Right? So something that you've seen with your own eyes, like you see a UFO, no matter how much people tell you that there's no such thing as UFOs, you saw a UFO. Right? It could have ended up being a figment of your eyesight. It could have been that you had something in your eye, right? But that's, even though it's not 100% ironclad, things that you see, things that you experience with your sensory perception are far more convincing for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi than things that you conclude in your mind. Now, I just want to point out that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi falls on the side of scientific inquiry. You see, the philosopher's world, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was definitely in the minority view in the medieval world wherein he's writing this, because science is not based on scientific method in the 12th century. Aristotle didn't have a laboratory where he experimented with different kinds of elements to come up with his theory of physics and metaphysics. The whole concept of the scientific method will not come up for another 4 to 5 centuries when basically the scientific community basically says, no, philosophy and science have to be divided from each other. The world of ideas, of theories that you come up with in your mind, if they're not tested in a test tube in the laboratory, then they have no value. That concept, that idea of scientific method of proving things and through experimentation, that whole lexicon doesn't even exist in this world. So for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to go up against the philosophical community and say, just because it's in your mind doesn't mean it's true, is pretty audacious for him to say that. Today, for us to say, well, just because it's in your mind doesn't mean it's true. Did you test it? Did you experience this? Everything written, you know, has it been gauged and properly double-blind studied and things like that? You know, that's what we would normally say. So this is very consistent with what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says. If it's experienced, because everyone is privy to the miracle, then that's the final evidence. And that's more in line with the way that we think today. But Aristotle didn't think that. Aristotle thought that you could ascertain truth about the world, about the elements, and so forth, through logical conclusions. So Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is really pretty much, he's ahead of his time. Okay. Now, the next step, after we've just basically said shalom, tzeischem l'shalom to the philosopher, is for him to go to the next person on the roster.
Afterwards, the Kuzari said to himself, "Let me ask Edom, Christian, and Ishmael, Muslim. Surely one of them must have desirable action. There is no point, however, in seeking out Judaism. The fact that the Jews are so small in number and universally despised proves that they must be wrong."
The fact that the Jews are so small in number and universally despised proves that they must be wrong. Because truth lies with the masses. It's a reasonable conclusion to come up with. If you've got a few billion people in the world, or maybe in this time of the world's existence, maybe have several hundred millions of people in the world, and most people are not Jewish, and most people really don't like Jews, then there must be something wrong with them. Has that attitude changed, by the way?
No.
Right? But it seems pretty logical when you think about it. Why are there so few Jews in the world today? Well, one, of course, is because of the second reason. They don't like us, so they kill us when they don't like us. So we haven't really grown very much. What?
But we,
well, there's also one of the reasons that Jews are so small is because it has never been, as we've mentioned before, it has never been the mission statement of Judaism to proselytize and to add people to our ranks. So the fact that most of the world is not Jewish is attributable perhaps to the fact that we have not made the effort to make people Jewish. That's never been our mandate. God did not say, make the rest of the world Jewish. So the smaller number part is not necessarily a very convincing argument. And remember, from the Kuzari's point of view, if you possess truth, then you would want to share that truth with everyone in the world. And if you want to share that truth with everyone in the world, I have to conclude that Jews made their message available to the rest of the world, and the world decided not to take advantage of it because they saw something flawed with it. So the fallacy of that argument is, number one, the assumption that just because something is true, everyone's going to latch onto it. That's number one, that's not necessarily true. What if the truth is painful? What if the truth hurts? And someone else provides you with a less truthful truth, but yet has some elements of truth that isn't as painful, isn't as difficult to adhere to. Which essentially is what Christianity offers. It really offers the salvation and the spiritual gratification of Judaism without all the work. And so if someone else offers you that, wouldn't you want, and you're seeking truth, wouldn't you want to latch onto that sooner than you would latch onto another kind of truth that says, our truth is a greater truth, but it requires a lot more effort and a lot more commitment. So the Kuzari doesn't take that into account either. And why do they despise us? Why are Jews universally despised? Is it possible that instead of the reason being why we're universally despised is because we possess falsehood, it might just be just the opposite. The reason why we're universally despised is because deep, deep down, somewhere in the subconscious of the rest of the world, they know that we do have the truth. And when you are trying to pass yourself off as possessing the truth, and you know someone else has a truer truth, then you resent that truer truth because it makes your truth look pale and look less appealing or less true. And maybe that's why they despise us. So that's not something that the Kuzari king takes in mind at this point. But those are certainly some reasons for anti-Semitism. Or maybe because, as Sigmund Freud once said, Christians don't hate Jews because we killed their Messiah. Christians hate Jews because we gave birth to their Messiah. And we gave the world a conscience. And we gave the world a sense of responsibility and a sense of purpose. And that the world is not, the life is not about gratifying oneself and filling oneself with happiness, pursuing happiness, but rather doing that which is meaningful and that which involves a higher purpose than just pleasing oneself. And that seems very unsettling. That's very discomforting to the rest of the world. If you know that there's someone who's always going to remind you that life is more about what's the pleasures of the moment. So that's another reason why they hate us. Because we gave birth to their God, we gave birth to Christianity, and we gave the world a sense of conscience. So those are things that the Kuzari doesn't take into account when he said the Jews can't have anything because they're so small a number and universally despised. Later on, he's going to actually throw even more insults at the Jewish people before he decides to adhere to them. Obviously, the Jews have been wandering for many centuries, so they've probably lost a lot of wisdom over the course of their wanderings as well. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to have to acknowledge that, ultimately, but despite all of the trials and tribulations that we've been through as a people, once you have the truth, it's very difficult to completely let go of it. And so even if we've been compromised over the course of centuries through all of our persecutions, we nevertheless have preserved the truth. And that's what he's going to be presenting to the Khazar king. So let's take a look at his call to the Christian scholar. Well, you know what? I think what we should do is I think we should save the call to the Christian scholar for next time. This would be a good place for us to start our discussion next week. Are there any questions or comments before we close the Kuzari? Anyone want to add anything? Yes, please.
What about the empirical evidence? You know, that they didn't use the evidence that we all got the Torah, and there were so many witnesses. that...
Well, that's precisely the empirical evidence is what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi subscribes to. Aristotle didn't believe in empirical evidence as being proof to anything, because empirical evidence, he felt, is not as convincing as intellectual evidence, the evidence of the mind. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is directly combating that. Yes?
But in order to subscribe to this evidentiary shita, right, that I need evidence, you have to believe me. And if you weren't the Palestinian, so there has to be a belief to accept the evidence.
Yes, that's an excellent question. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's he will provide us with evidence that he feels is extremely convincing, even though we weren't there at Har Sinai. And it'll be up to us to decide whether we find his evidence convincing or not. But his position is going to be that it is more plausible to believe in the evidence provided by Judaism than in the evidence provided by Christianity and Islam. Everyone has a certain degree of evidence. I mean, look, you've got, there's certain forms of evidence that Christians can provide. They say, look, this is the church where Jesus prayed. This is the road, the Via Dolorosa, where he walked down. This is where he's buried. So that could be a level of evidence. But at the end of the day, the evidence that's provided by Judaism is going to be the most convincing evidence, at least from Rabbi Yehuda Levi's point of view. And even though we weren't there, we're going to have to see whether we buy into the evidence or not. I'm going to keep you a little bit in suspense to hear what his evidence is going to be shortly. Okay, any other questions? Okay.